listening to KBOO Portland.
Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures, coming in 2019. That's right. The Film Show and Words and Pictures are coming together to fill the airwaves with the most creative happenings and fertile minds in screencraft, stagecraft, comics, and animation. So tune in to KBOO twice a month, 11:30 a.m. every second and fourth Thursday in 2019 and beyond, for the very best of the narrative arts on the new Words and Pictures.
Back home, folks.
These days, autistic people and their families are coming up with new ways to understand autism's unique gifts and challenges. Among other things, that means making the environment more inclusive for people with different minds and bodies.
So to understand what disability justice means, to incorporate that into our work, means not treating our lives or our communities as single issue. It means recognizing the whole humanity of every person.
That's Lydia X.E. Brown, an autistic activist, organizer, and lawyer. They spoke at the Colorado Trust, an organization that focuses on health equity.
It's not merely about checking the boxes. Do you have the sign language interpreter? Do you have the ramp? It's about making sure that individuals in your communities and in your work actually feel welcome without having to check pieces of themselves at the door.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today we talk to autistic adults, plus parents and educators of autistic young people, about how they're building a more accessible world. Later in the show, how designing classrooms for autistic students can benefit all students, and how children's museums can include autistic patrons in their exhibits. But first, when she noted that her young daughter had delayed speech and dramatic meltdowns, Professor Jen Malia went looking for answers. She discovered her daughter was autistic, but she also discovered something else, that she was also autistic. Now she's written a children's book that stars an autistic girl. Jen, the children's book you wrote is called Too Sticky, Sensory Issues with Autism. Why Too Sticky?
Well, with my own experience as a child, I had some sensory issues, and Too Sticky was just something that I think a lot of kids that are autistic have trouble with. Both myself and my daughter, we have trouble, you know, touching sticky things and want to wash our hands constantly. So I thought that that would be a good sensory issue to write about for children.
The book is loosely based on your own experience.
Yes, I didn't know I was autistic when I was a child. I wasn't diagnosed until I was an adult. But when I was looking for children's books for both myself and my kids, I had a lot of trouble finding books that were representing autistic characters in a way that was positive. So that was one of the reasons that I set out to write a book.
What do you now realize about the young you that had symptoms of autism?
Well, when I was younger, in my generation, now I'm 43, but in my generation, unless you had a severe case of autism, you know, normally you would not have been diagnosed. So at that time, I was very shy as a child. I had difficulty communicating. I'd often sit in classrooms being completely silent and not interacting much, unless I was really comfortable, you know, with, you know, a couple of friends that I had. But for the most part, you know, growing up, I knew that there was something wrong, but I didn't know what it was. And I knew that I had these sensory issues. I had trouble walking on like hardwood or tile floors, and just a lot of different sensory issues and difficulty communicating. Also, as a child, I used to line up all of my toys, not even realizing that that alone could be an autistic trait. But now that I know that that's something that's pretty common, you know, what I did was I actually learned how to play with toys from I had a brother growing up, and he taught me how to play with his Star Wars toys. That's how I learned how to play.
How can we understand it better? How was what you experienced not tidiness, fastidiousness, and shyness?
Right. I think that there's not really a look to autism. A lot of people have a sort of stereotypical view of what autism is. And I have to admit that until I got diagnosed, which was about 3 years ago, I myself had a very stereotypical view of autism. It was what I saw on Rain Man. You know, that's what I had a vision of. Someone that's, you know, very isolated and doesn't really communicate much with the outer world. And also, statistically, for every 4 boys that are diagnosed, only 1 girl is diagnosed. Autism presents differently in females. And so now there are a lot of girls and women being diagnosed that weren't or wouldn't have been, you know, in the past.
What prompted you to have a self-diagnosis of autism so late in your life?
Well, honestly, I wasn't actually looking to, like, at the time I was looking to figure out what was going on with my daughter. I have 3 kids, and my second child, when she was 2 years old, I noticed there was a lot of behavior issues, but also, you know, these sensory issues. She had a language delay. But when I would take her to doctors to try to figure out what was going on, I was constantly told that she had just a language delay. And I knew there was a lot more to that. So what I started doing is I researched, you know, being a PhD, you know, one thing I was good at was research. So I spent a lot of time, you know, reading hundreds of medical articles. It's not my field, but I knew that I needed to do that to figure out what was going on. And so what I discovered was that, you know, the only thing that kept coming up with all the things that I noticed that was going on with her was autism spectrum disorder. And then I realized, you know, probably a couple hundred hours more of research that, well, I was on the spectrum too.
Huh. What did you see in your 2-year-old that went beyond what you thought was language delay?
Well, we would have these, she had a lot of episodes, what are a lot of people, you know, refer to as autistic meltdowns, where she would be crying and kicking and screaming. And I could tell that there was a lot more going on than just a tantrum. So the main thing that I think is different with a tantrum, which she was 2 years old at the time, which is pretty common for a 2-year-old, mm-hmm. and a meltdown, is that it was a lot more severe. And it wasn't the type of thing where, you know, if she wanted something and if you gave her that, let's say she asked for a toy, you know, a 2-year-old can have a tantrum if you take that toy away. But with an autistic meltdown, even if you give the toy back, there's going to be a continuation of this kind of emotional breakdown, a sort of sensory overload, because at that point, if I gave my daughter the toy back, it would be too late because she can't control or, you know, emotionally regulate.
So in your children's book, Two Sticky Sensory Issues with Autism, you're trying to help children, parents, educators really understand autism better.
Yes. I would say that the main purpose that I have, or main goal that I have with this book, is not only to raise autism awareness, but also acceptance. And I think that second part is really important because I, for one, consider autism part of my identity. And so I like to refer to myself as an autistic woman, autistic mother, not just a person with autism, which is person first language is actually preferred by the medical community, but a lot of the autistic community prefer identity first language because we can't separate the autism from who we are. You know, my experiences are all through an autistic lens. So every experience that I've ever had has been based on my own experiences with, you know, having autism. And so when I think about one of the goals that I have for writing the book, it's specifically is to write a book for the autistic community, for autistic children who want to see some part of themselves in the book and can identify with the character who's going about her everyday life, which is exactly what we need to do every day.
Are there many other children's books about autistic children?
There are some other children's picture books that are written by neurotypical authors, but there are very few that are written from the perspective of someone, you know, who is living with autism.
You know, you must have so many people come up to you through all your writing in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Women's Day. You must have so many people saying, thank you, I so relate, both for myself and my children.
Yeah, in fact, I have a lot of readers that reach out to me. They, you know, they'll message me on my Facebook page and tell me that they were able to get diagnosed or they were able to get their, you know, sons or daughters diagnosed. I even had someone that I went to school with in middle school who reached out to me, and he just happened to come across an article he had read, and this was recently, and he sought his own diagnosis. It was something that, you know, for him, he had, you know, had gone through therapy as a child, but also was not diagnosed, and then he's looking into potentially getting his daughter screened as well.
What advice would you have for parents and children to recognize these character traits in children and colleagues and account for them? You know, be more understanding and accepting.
Yeah, I think that a lot of times with, you know, especially if, you know, my kids are more on the mild part of the spectrum, and I am as well. And I think a lot of times the reaction that I get when I, you know, mention that either, you know, myself or my kids are on the autism spectrum, it's something like, well, you seem to be doing fine. Like you have, you know, you're a professor and, you know, your kids are, you know, interacting really well with other kids here at the school. And a lot of times that's great, you know, that we are able to do all of these things, of course, but sometimes, you know, it kind of sort of pushes to the side the fact that we are, you know, having a lot of challenges that we have to deal with, and to kind of, you know, dismiss it as, well, you know, sometimes I'll hear things like, well, everybody is a little autistic, aren't they? You know, a lot of people who have PhDs and are studying intently and have hyper-focused interests and things like that. And that is true sometimes. There are definitely some people that are on the spectrum that are getting PhDs that, you know, may or may not want to pursue a diagnosis or just have autistic traits. But from the perspective of someone like myself who's diagnosed and does have significant challenges, and my kids do as well, acknowledging that, you know, we are different and we do need accommodation sometimes, and that even if, you know, if we look like we're doing just fine on the outside, sometimes there's things that are, you know, that we're holding in on the inside that are really difficult for us.
People are afraid to assume a work colleague or a child has autism.
Yeah, I think that's true, that there's still a lot of stigma about, you know, a lot of people I know don't actually want their, you know, writers who don't want to, you know, identify that their children are autistic if they're writing about them. I have treated it with my own family. I've been very open, of course, you know, writing articles about it. And also, you know, all of my colleagues, they know, because, I mean, I go to readings and I read about being autistic. But I've treated it as something that I'm proud of. And I know that, you know, everybody has their own preferences as to whether or not they want to be openly autistic. But for me, as I said, it's part of my identity. And I don't ever want my children to feel ashamed of being autistic. I want them to also be proud.
Well, Jen Malia, thank you for sharing your insights on autism on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jen Malia is an English professor at Norfolk State University. She's also the author of Too Sticky, Sensory Issues with Autism. Coming up next, how museums can design autism-accessible spaces. Jackie Spanauer is a museum professional and the mother of an autistic son. Now she's working on a research project about how museums can improve accessibility for autistic people. Jackie, you recently had a bad experience taking your 3-year-old son to a children's museum. What happened?
I did, actually. So my 3-year-old is on the autism spectrum, and my husband and I thought that the best place to take him would be somewhere already suited for children. So we decided to take him to a local children's museum, and there were a number of barriers there that we weren't expecting. Children who have autism tend to dart. They're a flight risk. And so when you go into a space that doesn't have areas that are blocked off or that don't have doorways, then your child is really free to run and dart and roam everywhere. And as a parent, you end up literally chasing them throughout the facility, and then they're not really learning anything or getting much from that experience other than you getting a 30-minute workout. Another issue that we had is they have this wonderful bubble room that I can remember going to as a child, and I knew my son loved bubbles and would love that room. And unfortunately, children with autism tend to zone in on one particular thing that they are fixated on. And there was this large place where they had the bubble liquid and they had multiple wands in that particular area. And each wand had a different color and had different shapes that it made. So the first time that we went in, my son zoned in on this particular wand, and that's the only one that he wanted to play with. And he had a great time. But then when we left that area and we came back, there was another child playing with that wand. And so you can imagine the meltdown that ensued because all of those wands were different and he wanted the pink one with the triangles instead of the yellow one with the circles. So what ended up happening is we just had to remove him from that situation, and we ended up taking him to a part of the facility that was actually designated for infants. So he was a little old for it, but that particular area had a door. So we ended up staying there in a spot that really wasn't great for his learning and didn't allow him to use the space wisely. So we were very disappointed with the experience. I don't think that it accommodates children on the spectrum very well, that particular facility. And to be honest, I'm not really sure if we'll go back.
That's so interesting. A place where you had gone and loved as a child did not work for your own child.
Yeah.
What's another example of something kind of common in children's spaces that doesn't work for a lot of kids on the autism spectrum?
Sure. When I went to the Children's Museum, once again, there was a section that had these tubes that children could climb into, which, of course, we all associate with childhood. We remember playing in those tubes at a McDonald's or some other place as a child. And it's not a great place for your child with autism because a lot of children on the spectrum do not either know their names or they are unable to communicate when they get stuck. And so my child was climbing in these tubes and getting in the very back of them. And I, as an adult, would have had a very difficult time trying to get to him if I needed to. So those, although they work well for neurotypical children, children with autism, it's a little bit more difficult. You really have to think about safety with children with autism, and you have to make sure that you're thinking about how parents can have easy access and line of vision with their child at all times. And I was surprised that we had that kind of issue again at a children's museum where you would think these accommodations were already in place.
I can see how museums could get it wrong and never realize it.
There are some museums that are working really hard to make accommodations at their facilities to ensure that children on the spectrum are able to come and be comfortable. There's been some museums that I've been to that have started creating spaces with different types of seating for like a children's reading group, or places when they're doing crafts, they're more mindful of the fact that children with autism who are younger tend to explore with their mouths and they'll eat everything. Right. So they have bigger beads, or they have pipe cleaners because they're better for dexterity as opposed to having a piece of string that you have to actually tie a knot. So there are some facilities that are trying to incorporate those things and are getting them done well, but I personally have not visited a children's museum that I feel like is really doing it well.
Name one that you've come across that was doing it the best you've seen so far.
So I've been writing a book called Museums and Millennials, and as part of that research, I interviewed someone from the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center. They are a relatively new museum that's out in Arkansas, and they have a variety of families, specifically African American families. They're an African American cultural center that are coming to their facility almost daily, and they are serving them very well. And they realized that they had a lot of children that were coming that were on the spectrum and that they needed to make changes so that those families felt comfortable. So they are the ones that I've personally talked to that are really just doing wonderful. They're doing trainings constantly with their staff. But they're also recognizing that children with autism have difficulty staying on task and they have difficulty following directions. So when they're having an event or something, they actually use colored duct tape and they put it on the ground to tell the child, follow the yellow duct tape, and then they'll end up at a stop sign and then they'll do an activity. And then at that point, they'll say, please follow the blue tape, and they'll go to another stop sign. So they're doing a really nice job of using nonverbal cues to communicate with a population that has a lot of nonverbal people. And honestly, if you work for a museum facility and you don't know where to start, the best thing to do is to find your local autism community. You can do that by calling a developmental pediatrician's office. They often can direct you to all of the local resources. There's many national groups that have local chapters. So the best thing to do is to educate yourself in order to make those accommodations and ask that group what they need so that they can come and enjoy your facility.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about this because I know how much parents love reading hours at libraries for children, children's museums, places where they can take their children and have a blast and get outside the home. And if you need that for children without the sensory needs, just imagine how much the parents of children on the spectrum extra need it, right?
Right, right. I'm part of a number of Facebook groups and things, and daily, I mean daily, multiple times a day, I'm seeing people post about their young child and how they're unable to find anything social for them to do. And we love getting our children together who have sensory issues, but it still, again, our main fight is for inclusion. And I think if we keep segregating our children with autism and ADHD and Down syndrome and all of these other special needs from mainstream children, then we're really doing a disservice to mainstream children and families, because we have so much to teach them. They have so much to teach us. And as we're, you know, living in a world now that is so politically charged and there's this huge lack of compassion, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get all of these kids to grow up together and realize that different is beautiful, and to ensure that all of our children could grow up in a world where compassion was king?
Jackie Spanauer is vice president of the Hunter House Victorian Museum in Norfolk, Virginia, and a recipient of the Virginia Association of Museums Leadership and Advocacy Fellowship. Like museums, schools can sometimes be inaccessible for autistic learners. Radford University Professor of Special Education Leslie Daniel wants to change that. She has some ideas for designing more autism-friendly classrooms.
Some of my favorite strategies, and I have a few go-to ones, using visual supports is probably one of my number ones, and that includes giving somebody a visual schedule, whether that be with pictures or just written words or a combination, to let somebody know, hey, here's what's happening through the day. Sometimes we think, oh, they get it now. The person with autism doesn't need the visual anymore. And they don't on an average day, perhaps. But then comes the out of the average day. You know, there's a snowstorm and they've got a two-hour delay to get to school. So when they get to school, there's no breakfast served. Well, they're used to getting to school and having breakfast, and people with autism often rely on routine. So a visual can help them see, okay, we got here late, so this is where we are on the schedule now. Another favorite for me is using wait time. And wait time is when you ask a question or give a direction and then shut up. So if I say, pick up your pencil, usually teachers are like, come on, John, I said pick up your pencil. Where's your pencil? Don't you have a pencil? Well, the kid with autism is processing, and they're still on the first one, and now you've said it three more times, and they got to process it. They're not being noncompliant. Their brains are slowly processing what you said, and particularly if you've gotten louder or angrier, they've got to process, wait, there's another voice. It's a different voice. What does that mean? So I teach my students, as a rule of thumb, to wait for 15 seconds. Now, most teachers wait a little less than 2 seconds before giving redirect. So 15 seconds can seem like a long time. So I teach my students to count their Mississippis. A good rule of thumb I like to teach my students is to wait for 15 seconds, counting their Mississippis, letting the person process. Now, some people, And what I teach people is to pay attention to when did they process. So it might really be that the person needed 4 seconds. Or, you know, I've worked with somebody who had a 5-minute processing. Now, you can't wait 5 minutes in a classroom. You can wait 15 seconds, particularly if you're preparing all of the students. Hey, we're going to wait until everybody's had time to think.
Let's try it out. I just want to see what that feels like. Let's just do 10 seconds.
Okay. So that's 5. And that's 10.
Wow.
That's a big pause.
It's actually nice, isn't it? It's nice to have a pause.
It's nice. And so going back to, I try and teach my students not just that it's good for people with autism, but it is good for all kids, because we don't give enough think time in general.
You've also said one of your soapboxes is about friendships. how teachers can work to build relationships between neurotypical students and students with autism.
Yes, and I don't like fake friendships. I don't want to say, oh, you have to be this person's friend today. But I like building opportunities for friendships to grow a little more naturally. But people with autism might need a little help to get to know other people. They don't necessarily know the rules of certain aspects of friendship. And the thing is, kids need to be with other kids to learn those rules. But somebody who doesn't know the rules doesn't have an easy time being with other kids. So they're caught in a catch-22 sometimes. So I like building groups. I like building varied groups. In my own college classroom, I change up groupings on a very regular basis. Sometimes you should get to work with your friends or the people you're sitting nearest to. And sometimes, hey, let's let you get to know somebody else and learn a little bit about them, because they won't necessarily be so other if you've been in a group and you've gotten to talk with them and you've learned their name. So teachers can be mindful of helping people foster relationships.
Isn't it a big problem if the children don't realize this other children is coping with autism and instead just feel bothered?
Sure, absolutely. And sometimes with parent permission and child permission, I have, when I was in a K-12 classroom, said, okay, here's what's going on with this person, but only if I have parent and child permission.
Right.
Because, you can't disclose somebody's disability. So if I can share more about that and then share also from the perspective of we all have differences. I wear glasses, for instance. I'm also very tall for a woman. So talking about how that impacts my day. And talking about what autism is. And there's some wonderful storybooks that people can get and read with classes, again, with family permission, and with and without the person with autism there. Sometimes you might want to have a more difficult conversation that the person would rather not be around for. But as much as possible, I like to celebrate. Autism comes with a lot of strengths.
I'm super curious about the strengths.
Yes. So autism, some people with autism have an incredible focus, an incredible eye for detail that they can hone in on and use that as a big strength. So autism is not just about weaknesses and deficits. It comes with skills that many of us wish we had. I had one former student who could look down at the ground and see a four-leaf clover and pick it up.
Yeah.
He became incredibly popular on the trip to Monticello one year when in about 2 hours he found 9 four-leaf clovers. I've never once in my life found a four-leaf clover, though I have looked. And
right.
He can just bend down and because that's his eye for detail. He can see in a field of green clovers the one that is four-leaf. And I know a lot of people with autism who would not do without their autism. I am not somebody who wants to cure autism. I like people with autism, but I do want to help people with autism be comfortable in the life that they choose to live and to have the skills that they want.
Well, Leslie Daniel, this is fascinating. Thank you for sharing with me and with good reason.
Thank you for having me.
Leslie Daniel is a professor of special education at Radford University and teaches in the Autism Studies Certificate Program. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. At about 3 p.m., fast food restaurants across the country start filling up with teenagers. Burgers and fries seem to go hand in hand with kids. What is it that draws them to fast food joints? To learn more about the eating habits of teenagers, George Mason University sociologist Amy Best went straight to the source. Through careful observation in cafeterias and fast food joints, Best gained some insights into why kids eat what they eat and ways to push them to make better choices. Amy, where were you when you first started thinking about kids and fast food?
I was actually at a fast food restaurant.
Because you were hungry or because you were observing?
I actually went there just to eat. And I got myself some food, and I was sitting down to do some grading, and I looked around, and it was right at the end of the school day, and all of a sudden, there was just a flood of kids. And I had just come off of another research project, and I thought, wow, what's going on here? This is really interesting. And I went back a couple more times, and then I thought, I wonder if it's like this in other places.
What did you notice about kids who go to Chipotle? What was happening as they were enjoying meals in groups?
I noticed lots of food talk.